the theme of that song that we just sung is the only thing that allows me to be up here right now. One of the thoughts that we had when we were talking about doing what we're doing on Sunday night was that it would help us all by going over the highlights of these chapters to get a better overall picture of the seamless story, which is the Bible. How we got here, what we're doing here, what's going to happen to us when we leave here, and how God brought that all about. Obviously, I'm just going to hit some high points, in my opinion, of these chapters. There is nothing in the book of Judges that is not important. There are no idle words anywhere in the scriptures. So if I miss a point that you think ought to be made, and I will, get my attention and make it. Raise your hand, throw a pencil at me, preferably eraser first, but get my attention and make it, because you don't know who will benefit from it. And as I said, I'm not going to get them all. We're going to pick up in Judges chapters. We're going to start in chapter 6. In 6 through 8, we have the story of Gideon. Israel does evil before the Lord, and he delivers them into the hand of the Midianites. And they destroy Israel's food supply, leaving them impoverished. They cry out to the Lord, and he appoints Gideon as judge. Gideon's told to destroy his father's altar to Baal, cut down the wooden image that is next to it, to build an altar to the Lord and use that wooden image that he cut down to offer a burnt offering to the Lord, which he does. Gideon needs a little reassurance, so he has a request of God that put a fleece on a threshing floor, and that first night the fleece is wet, floor is dry. Second night, fleece is dry and the floor is wet. God does this for him to reassure him. We move on into chapter 7. And the Lord chooses 300 men of all those that came out to do battle with Midian to make it clear that the victory would come through the Lord and not the strength of Israel. Gideon is permitted to go to the camp of the Midianites and overhears a dream and its interpretation that further assures him that the Lord is with him. And sure enough, Israel defeats Midian in battle. It was a curious way that the Lord chose the 300 men that would go with him. One of the things I read was that said that those men that drank water that way did so in a manner that paid attention to what was going on around them versus those who got down on their knees and drank water and were oblivious to everything. That they were more of a true soldier. And I guess that could be. Although God could have used the worst of them to bring about what he was going to bring about. But another interesting thought, and this is neither here nor there, it's just so you'll know. Most of the time when men that drink water, the way it's described there, they dip their hand in water and they bring it to their mouth. They don't generally dip their hand in water and swing around this way and bring it to their mouth. They just bring it up. If you've ever watched a dog drink water in slow motion, his tongue curls out and comes around backwards and brings water into his mouth. Sandra found that really interesting because there were no slow motion YouTube videos of a dog drinking water in those days. But God knew how he did it. Chapter 8, the men of Ephraim, who were in fact part of the battle, reprimand Gideon for not calling them when he first went out to fight against Midian. Gideon points out to them that it was the Lord who handed over the princes of Midian into their hand, which seems to help ease their anger. Gideon and those 300 men proceed on, and they ask bread of the men of Succoth and Penuel, and they're denied help, basically because the men of those cities were still afraid of the Midianites. But Gideon goes on, and he's victorious. He and his 300. And he returns and punishes those men that refused help. The men of Israel want Gideon to rule over them, but his reply to them is that it's the Lord who would rule over them. He then makes an ephod and sets it up in his hometown of Ophrah. It ends up being a snare to both him and his household because the people choose to worship it instead of the Lord. I know it may be hard to understand, but for us today anyway, but there's a key phrase that's going to come along here in a little while in Judges. It'll maybe help clear some of that up. Midian was defeated. The land had rest for 40 years in the days of Gideon. He dies at a good old age, and unfortunately, Israel again rejects the Lord and returns to their idol worship, and they also fail to show any kindness or appreciation to the house of Gideon. In chapter 9, Abimelech, one of the sons of Gideon by a concubine, goes to Shechem to his mother's brothers and proposes that he, rather than his 70 brothers, rule over them. They agree, and he sets out and kills his 70 brothers so that he can become king over Shechem. Jotham is the only one who escapes by hiding himself. He then speaks a curse to the men of Shechem from Mount Gerizim. Abimelech reigned over Israel for 3 years, and God sent a spirit of ill will between him and the men of Shechem. And in the end, God repays all of them for the evil that they had done, fulfilling Jotham's curse. Judges in chapter 10 are Tola, who judged Israel for 23 years and dies. Jer judged Israel for 22 years and dies. Israel again forsakes the Lord and worships idols. And the anger of the Lord was hot against them, and he sells them into the hands of the Philistines and the people of Ammon. Israel cries out to the Lord for deliverance, but the Lord, after recalling all the great things he had done for them, tells them, "Go and cry to your chosen gods for help." Israel puts away those idols and serves the Lord. Jephthah is the next judge in chapters 11 and 12. He becomes a judge, and before going to battle against Ammon, makes a vow about what he will do if Israel is victorious. Israel is victorious. That vow was to offer whatever comes out his doors to greet him when he returns from battle. To the best of my understanding, that has to be a human being, because they didn't generally keep their sheep and their cattle inside. That's where people lived. So that had to be a human being coming out the door that he intended to offer. And it was just a sign of the influence of all the other people around them that did those sort of things. Just as an option, though, let's just say that the Lord came to him and said, "What are you doing? Who told you to make such a vow? Where did you get the idea that you could vow something like that?" What would his options have been when his daughter came out the door? Well, I don't know what they all could have been. But I know that if he'd have realized what a fool he'd been, he could have told God, "I'm breaking the vow, kill me." But he didn't. That's another thing that we'll get to when that key verse shows up. In chapter 12, the tribe of Ephraim again complains about not being called to battle when they thought they should have been. But this time, it leads to the men of Gilead going against them in battle. Gilead wins that battle, and 42,000 men of Ephraim die because of it. In the rest of the chapter, it talks about Jephthah judged Israel for 6 years. Then Ibzan judges for 7 years. Elon judges for 10 years. Abaddon judges for 8 years. In chapter 13 through 16, we come to Samson. Israel, again, does evil in the sight of the Lord. And he delivers them to the hands of the Philistines. The angel of the Lord foretells the birth of Samson. Samson is indeed born. He grows, and the Spirit of the Lord moves upon him. Later, he desires a wife from the daughters of the Philistines. His parents, of course, would rather he take a wife from his own people. But in verse 4 of chapter 14, it says, "But his father and mother did not know that it was the Lord, that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines. For at that time, the Philistines had dominion over Israel." And so begins the time, the battle between Samson and the Philistines. The story goes on about how he's given strength from the Lord and kills a lion, how he later finds the honey in the carcass of that lion, the riddle that he poses to those 30 people at the wedding feast, the 30 men at the wedding feast. He shares the answer to that riddle with his wife, who reveals the answer to the Philistines, who then answer the riddle to Samson. And of course, the bet was 30 changes of clothes. So Samson has to come up with 30 changes of clothes. He is, however, very much aware of how the Philistines got that answer. The Spirit of the Lord comes upon him, and he kills 30 men of Ashkelon and takes their clothes and gives it to those who solve the riddle. His anger was aroused, and he goes back to his father's house. He later returns to his wife, only to learn that her father has given her to Samson's companion, thinking that he truly hated her. Samson then goes about to burn the Philistines' grain, vineyards, and olive groves. Philistines find out it was Samson who did this and burn both his wife and father-in-law to death. Samson swears revenge and slaughters a great number of them, and then goes to Edom. The Philistines come for Samson, come for him there, and the men of Judah, in fear, hand him over to them. But the Spirit of the Lord again comes upon Samson, and he kills 1,000 of them with the jawbone of a donkey. And then he crosses paths with Delilah. He evidently loved her, but it doesn't appear that she felt the same way towards him. She repeatedly attempted to discover the source of his strength, and when she finally does, she uses it for her own personal gain and shaves off Samson's hair and hands him over to the Philistines. With his strength gone, he's captured by them. They put out his eyes, and they take him captive. His hair then begins to grow back, and when the Philistines give a feast to their god Dagon for delivering Samson over them, they call for Samson to entertain them. There's about 3,000 men and women, it says, in the temple complex there. When Samson calls on the Lord one last time for strength, he braces himself, puts his hands on the two pillars that he's between, pushes on them with all his might, and the temple collapses, killing him and everybody else. It is said that he killed more people in death than he did in life. And he judged Israel for 30 years. Chapter 17 is the story of an idolatrous man named Micah and his acquiring his idols and a Levite to be his priest. It's in verse 6 of this chapter that we learn a phrase that helps explain some of the things that have gone on in Judges. "In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes." Can you think of a verse that would explain how wrong that is? Probably didn't ask that very well. Jeremiah 10:23, that's the verse, yeah. So we can know that things didn't go well during this period of time. Because, it's, you know, essentially what it just came down to was, you know, yeah, it's fine with me. Sounds good to me. It just was a time when people just forsook God in many ways. And if you think back, maybe that helps us understand a little bit about Gideon and his ephod, Jephthah and his vow. Because although people had some allegiance to Jehovah God, it was mixed in with all their other idolatrous practice that they did. Judges chapter 17, verse 13 says, "Then Micah said, once he gets his Levite, now I know that the Lord will be good to me, since I have a Levite as priest." He has all of his idols set up. He has his Levite priest consecrated. He feels like he's covered all his bases. Kind of like those guys that the Apostle Paul spoke to in Acts 17:33 that had this idol to an unknown God, just trying to cover all their bases. Verse 1 of chapter 18 begins with, "In those days there was no king in Israel. The tribe of Dan was seeking their land inheritance and sends men to spy out Laish. They come to Micah's house and find the Levite, who's the priest there, and they ask him to inquire of God if their journey is going to be a prosperous one. He tells them to go in peace. The presence of the Lord is with you. The report of the land is good, so they go to take the land. They go to take Lachish. And they pass by Micah's house again, and the five men who originally went there said, you know, there's a lot of idols there, and there's a Levite priest there. And so they go, and they take Micah's idols, and they even get his Levite priest to go with them. Sure enough, they subdue Lachish. They change the name of it to Dan, and they set up the idols that they had taken from Micah, and they consecrate priests that don't have a right to be priests. Chapter 19 also begins, "And it came to pass in those days when there was no king in Israel." There was a Levite who had a concubine, and she left him to go back to her father, and he went back to get her, and he did so. They're on their way back home, and they get to Gibeah, and they're going to spend the night there. Old man of the city finally takes them into his house and takes care of them. And then a bunch of perverted men from the city come beating on the door, wanting to have a sexual relationship with the guy. The old man of the house tries to prevent it, but is unsuccessful. So they end up giving them the concubine that the Levite went back to get. They abused her all through the night and ended up causing her death. I guess they never read about Sodom and Gomorrah, because it's pretty much word for word, same story. I guess the saying, you know, if you don't know history, you're doomed to repeat it. The Levite takes her home, dismembers her into 12 pieces, and sends her body parts throughout Israel. And they say that, you know, such a thing's never been done before. And hopefully will never be done again. Chapter 20, Israel goes to battle against Benjamin because they refuse to turn over those responsible for what happened in Gibeah. They inquire of the Lord, and he says, go, and the first day they lose 22,000 in battle. they go back and inquire of the Lord again, and the second day they lose 18,000. Inquire again, and he says, go, and the third time they're victorious. 600 are really all that's left of the men of Benjamin, and they have fled toward the wilderness to the rock of Rimmon. And they stayed there at that rock for 4 months. I'm going to ask a question here. Why do you suppose Israel lost the first two battles after God said to go? And, you know, in all honesty, we don't have any idea what that's like. I mean, we've got some problems in this country. I mean, and nobody denied that. But I just can't imagine what it would have been like living in those times when people did the things that are talked about here. And I don't know what the reason is, but I think it's exactly what Les said, is that we don't know about all the other immorality that went on. You know, these people, their attitude could have been something like, you know, how dare something like this happen, you know. Because there was a guy that we were told about, there was a couple of guys that went up to pray. And this one guy was really glad that he wasn't like all other men. You know, he was a really great guy. Well, there's probably people at this time that thought that very same thing about themselves. That they were better than everybody else. And, you know, who knows why those particular men died. But I think it is a clear indication of just how bad things really were at that time. And all because people made a choice to not seek God in their lives. In chapter 21, verse 2, it says, "Then the people came to the house of God and remained there before God till evening. They lifted up their voices and wept bitterly." They were sorry because of the sinfulness of the tribe of Benjamin and what had happened to them. So much so that they talked about there being a tribe missing. And sure enough, with 600 men left and the rest of Israel refusing to give their daughters to those 600 men as wives, when those guys died, Benjamin was gone. So they find a way to provide wives for those remaining 600 men. They end up killing all the people of Jabesh-Gilead because they refused to come to the assembly of the Lord. But they saved the lives of 400 virgins and gave them to those men as wives. The remaining men were to catch a wife from the daughters of Shiloh when they performed their dance at the feast of the Lord. And maybe I'm missing something here, I don't know. But it kind of says that way, these men, they weren't really guilty of giving their wives to those men of Benjamin. The men of Benjamin just took them. Those guys could be politicians today, sound like to me. It's kind of six in one, half a dozen in the other. But The book of Judges ends with that statement. There is no king in Israel at that time. Every man did what was right in his own eyes. And I don't think that statement is there as many times as it is by accident. Questions? Comments? Are you better off for reading the book of Judges? Did you gain something from it? Yes. I had read something to that effect, and that may well be the case. I just wasn't sure of that. But that may well be the case, that she didn't have to die. I tried to look up some of those things, those words maybe that would maybe give me the idea that wasn't a literal sacrifice. But I just didn't know enough to know that for sure. But that very well may be. Rick? Yes.
Well, I know you don't have much time for comments, but that story and that I happened to run across it in a totally different context this past week, listening to a British BBC production. Atheist spokesman. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a book called The God Delusion. And this program that I listened to was basically him telling why nobody should believe the Bible or any other religion. And he brought up this business of the concubine being left to the perverts, you know, in the city. And abusing her, and she's dead. And this is just a comment about how things are used sometimes by the opposition. He made as though those were God's instructions to the Levite to do this. And so he poses the question, is this the kind of God that we want to draw our morals from? But that was not the case, of course. realize that what we see in the book of Judges is the sin of a nation who is turning their back on the God that delivered them from slavery. And ultimately, it is all of these accumulation of all of these sins that they then are taken into captivity and many killed. And if it wasn't for God's promise to see through the lineage to Christ, the children of Israel would have been no better than any of the nations, because they did the same thing that the nations did. So they ultimately, the Bible is incomplete without seeing Christ as the fulfillment of perfect purity, innocence, sinlessness. If you take out the New Testament and all that is encompassed there, the forgiveness of sins, no, it doesn't make any sense. And it can be very discouraging and confusing to someone who is not accustomed to reading these things. And they start in the book of Judges, or they start in other places in the Bible that have some very disturbing things happening, immoral things happening, as though this is God's way. It's not God's way. It is anything but God's way. But it is what happened. And that's why they're recorded there. That is what happened. And we need to look at that and say, we don't want any part of that. And as you said, if you don't know history, then mankind is being repeated. And we see that now as well. We see that. Pardon me.
No. And I mean, does it not give each one of us confidence? We're all expecting to go to heaven, right? That's what we're doing, all that we're doing. We're not like Sadducees. We're not doing this to have a good life. We expect to go to heaven. Does it not give us all confidence to look and see how God has a plan? And despite everything that Satan can do to bring about the evil that he does, God still brings about his plan. He will still save those who are faithful to him. He will, when the time comes, sentence Satan to his eternity in torment. All those things he will do, despite everybody going against him to the degree that they have. It didn't keep him from accomplishing a single thing that he intended to do. That should give us complete, total confidence that we will spend an entire eternity in heaven. Nothing is going to go wrong. Nothing's going to change that. It is as sure as anything can possibly, it's as sure as God is. And all these things that happen and I know that this seems, these people and at this time and all these things that we see seems, you know, well, I wouldn't have done that if I was there, you know. Well, all we've got to do is look at our own lives and ask, you know, well, do we really have the faith that we should? Do we really depend upon God all the time the way we should? Do we have the faith in him that he's going to see us through some things that we think we've just got to handle? We let God down too, is what I'm saying. And we can have confidence that even if we do, he's willing to forgive us for those times that we do. Because he saw the children of Israel through all this. And when we get to other books in this Old Testament, we will see his willingness to forgive the evil that was going on all around Israel if they just repent of it. Anybody else? Ruth, I don't really feel like I need to say much. I feel like everybody here could say it as well as I could, or far better. It's a book we all know.
Elimelech and his family leave Judah because of a famine and go to Moab. He dies. His wife Naomi and their two sons are left. Those sons marry women of Moab, and about 10 years or so after that, the two sons die. So Ruth is left with her two daughters-in-law. She decides to return to Judah after hearing that the famine there has ended, tells her two daughter-in-laws that that they need to return to their mother's house. But Ruth, of course, refuses to do so, and the two of them return to Bethlehem. And Naomi feels that that God has dealt bitterly with her. At least right now she does. The second chapter, Ruth goes to glean grain from the fields and comes to a field of a man named Boaz, who owns it. He's a part of Elimelech's family. He treats her well, having heard what she'd done for Naomi. In chapter 3, Naomi, in her concern for Ruth, advises her on how to approach Boaz to know if he will be the family redeemer or perform the duty, I think, as the King James Version says. Boaz tells Ruth that there is a closer relative that has the right to do that, and if he will, so be it. But if not, then Boaz says he will. And he sends Ruth back to her mother-in-law. The closer relative says he can't be that redeemer of Elimelech's property because of the conditions that go along with it. So Boaz does, just as he said he would. And this is chapter 4, of course. And he marries Ruth. And he takes care of her and Naomi. And it's there we see that they become part of the lineage of Christ. Now, I'm going to do the first four chapters of Samuel and then let you make any comments about Ruth or Samuel that you want to. Chapter 1 of 1 Samuel is the birth of Samuel. Hannah, one of two wives of Elkanah, is childless and prays to the Lord for a son. God grants her her request. And just as she had promised, she dedicates him to the Lord. You know, God answered Hannah's prayer. She prayed for something, and God answered that prayer with a yes. And her response to that is to keep the vow that she made. Do you think that you and I act as honorably when we pray to God for things and He grants those things to us? Do we use those things in a way that He would be pleased with? Because that's another way that we can let Him down, just being selfish and self-centered about the things that He gives to us. Hannah didn't do that. Chapter 2, she prays a prayer to the Lord. God continues to bless her with more children. It talks about the evil conduct of Eli's sons that caused men to abhor the offering of the Lord. Samuel ministers and continues to grow before the Lord. There's a prophecy against Eli's house, and God tells Eli that both his sons will die in a single day. In chapter 3, Samuel's called by the Lord. God tells Samuel he's going to bring judgment against the house of Eli. In verse 13 of chapter 3, it says, "For I have told him that I will judge his house forever for the iniquity which he knows, because his sons made themselves vile, and he did not restrain them." Eli knows that God has spoken to Samuel, and he asks what the Lord said to him. Samuel tells him. Eli's response, "It is the Lord. Let him do what seems good to him." And at that time, all Israel knows that Samuel is now established as a prophet. Chapter 4, Israel engages in battle with the Philistines and is defeated. Israel loses 4,000 men. The people decide to bring the Ark of the Lord from Shiloh. Israel again goes to battle with the Philistines and is defeated. They lose 30,000 foot soldiers that time. The two sons of Eli are killed, and the Ark of the Covenant is captured. When Eli's told the news, he falls from his seat, breaks his neck, and dies. He's judged Israel for 40 years. The wife of Phinehas gives birth to a son and names him Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel," and then she dies. comments? And probably at the time of Eli, them two guys would have been dead. That would have been their punishment for the conduct that they were guilty of. Let's have a prayer.